Welcome to the Consumerism Commentary Podcast. I'm Luke Landis. My guest today is the New York Times sketch guy, Carl Richards, also the author of The Behavior Gap and his new book, The One-Page Financial Plan. Carl will also be the keynote speaker at FinCon this September. Carl, thanks for joining me today.
Luke, I'm really excited to talk with you. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, anytime. We're going to talk today a little bit about the One-Page Financial Plan. And, you know, it's surprising to me because when I think of financial plan, I think of a pretty thick document, you know, at least 10, 20, 50 pages. I can't imagine what it would take to get all of the information that people need about their goals, projections, budgets, investments all onto one page. So what does a one-page financial plan look like?
Yeah, first I have to tell you a funny story real quick. My daughter, about the title, my daughter, who was 9 at the time of this conversation, I heard her talking to a friend, and she was like, "My dad's really busy," and her friend said, "What's he doing?" My daughter said, "He's working on his new book." The friend says, "What's it called?" My daughter says, "The One-Page Financial Plan," and then there's this long pause, and the friend says, "Well, why is it taking him so long?" That was really great. So it's clear, right? You're going to do a lot of work. When it comes to financial planning, there's going to be documents. And I think saying that you've seen 10 or 20 page plans is being modest, right? I've seen 200 page thick, you know, books. But the problem with those books is not that there's not valuable information. It's that we never use them. Like I've never seen somebody, let me pull out my financial plan and reference it. And so a financial plan becomes almost like a product or an event in most of our minds. Like, okay, I got my financial plan done. And that's, to me, that's the main sort of paradigm I was trying to break and shift a little bit, is that planning is not a product or an event. It's a process, and it's an ongoing process. And so in order to make it an ongoing process, you have to have something to reference. And so that, to me, is what the one-page financial plan is. You take all that stuff. Maybe this is a good comparison. If you've ever put together an IKEA shelf or a children's toy, complex children's toy, you know there's a 50-page owner's manual or a sort of instruction manual in the box. And if you want the thing to be put together correct, you're probably going to have to reference it. But while you're working on it, I'm telling you, at least for me, the single most important thing is the picture on the front of the box. It tells me if I'm headed in the right direction. And I end up looking at that far more often. So the goal of the one-page plan is take all that other work you've done, important work that still needs to be done, and reduce it down to a simple statement of why you're doing this. I call that sort of your money why, a value statement. And mine's on page 11. So it just simply says, spend time with my kids doing things we love. And then, so that's sort of this reminder of why you're doing all this. It may be so I can be secure in retirement, so I don't end up like my parents, so we can take that trip in 20 years that we've really been wanting to take. You know, whatever it is that's like sort of the big, deep yes that allows you to say no to all those distractions, that's up there. And then, two or three of the things that are top of mind that you're working on right now. Like, it could be pay off my student loans. You know, that's what I'm focused on right now. For us, it's fund retirement account, fund our kids' education accounts, and save money for a house. That's what's important to us right now. And the reason, sorry, this is such a long-winded answer, but I get so fired up about it. The reason that's important is because that document's actually here on my shelf. And the other day, somebody came to me and said, "Hey, do you want to invest in this little company I'm starting?" And I love that stuff. Who doesn't? We're such suckers for, it's exciting, it's fun, it's startup. I used to spend 3 weeks analyzing, meeting with people, reviewing, you know, projections. This time I spent 3 minutes because I looked at that's right. We're totally focused on this right now. And it gave me the deeper yes to say no to that distraction. So that's the goal of the one-page plan.
I like how you've described this process. The last time you were here on the podcast, you said that the process itself is sometimes even more important than the result of the process or the document itself. Going through this process can be rather difficult. Some of the things that you said, you know, deciding on what your focus should be. I think a lot of times we're just overwhelmed by all the things that we do need to focus on. So how do you make some of those decisions?
Yeah, very thoughtfully, right? Like, and I agree. I think actually what's interesting is kind of the concepts behind being smart about money are pretty darn simple, right? Like, spend a little less than you make, save for a rainy day, you know, buy a diversified portfolio, keep your costs low, and behave. Like, that's not really all that complex. Where it gets complex is this, what we're talking about, right? The, navigating the emotional side of it. So, you know, like, how do you decide what's really important to you? You know, well, you have some conversations. That's what I've sort of outlined in the first three chapters of the book, or the sort of template for people to have these conversations around money. I mean, you start talking about it. You know, actually, I think this all starts with just simply noticing, right? Noticing what you're doing. We're most of us, and I myself included, we're constantly walking through life sort of half asleep. And particularly when it comes to our financial decisions, we're just doing stuff either because we've always done it. We'd never admit this, right? We'd never admit it. We're either doing it because we've always done it. It's what the neighbors are doing. You know, it's what we heard on the Financial Pornography Network. You know, we're filling random prescriptions. In other words, we're living other people's lives financially. And just the process of starting to notice that and be thoughtful and on purpose, like, wait, you know what? I don't care that every personal finance expert in the world tells me I'm a latte loser because I spend $4 a morning on my coffee. I really value it. Right? Okay, then do it. Right? Mm-hmm. Or maybe you'll find something opposite. Like, you know what? Turns out that car that I leased, you know, it was an extra couple hundred bucks a month over the sort of utilitary version that I'm a Toyota Camry or whatever I could have gotten, is not really bringing me all that much happiness. Well, next time I get a new car, I can get the cheaper one because I can spend that money instead on that trip that would bring me. So just noticing is how we start. And we're so used to not doing that. Like, we just aren't paying attention.
These are really difficult questions. You may come to the conclusion that the car that you have isn't making you happy, but how do you know what does make you happy? And how do you know, what to kind of funnel that money into in order to replace or fulfill some of the more internal desires that you have?
It's such a good question. I think the way you know is you just start paying attention a little bit, right? Mm-hmm. Just start noticing, wow, you know what? Going on that walk every morning with my wife on the trail behind our house, I really, really enjoy that. Right? Taking the dog out for a walk, throwing the tennis ball. Like yesterday, I just got involved with a spontaneous game of catch with my daughter with a tennis ball. And, it took me 5 minutes to finally say, wait, be here. Because I wanted to go off and do something else. And after about 20 minutes of just playing catch, then we moved to Frisbee. And at the end, I was like, that was amazing. Right? I really enjoyed that. And it's just because I know. So I'm pretty sure this is really hard to do, simple, but not easy, right? I'm pretty sure if we just listen a little more and pay attention inside, sort of just give ourselves a little bit of room, like turn off the Financial Pornography Network for a little bit, get a little quiet and think about the things that bring us happiness. I'm pretty sure we all have a one-page financial plan inside. We just need to sort of listen carefully enough to put it on a piece of paper.
Yeah, it sounds like you're talking about being present or being in the moment and how important that is to living a fulfilled life. And how do you take that and build a financial plan around that? I mean, is it just a question of figuring out what you need in order to have the freedom to live in the moment without stressing about money?
Well, there's a lot in that question. I mean, let me unpack it a little bit. Like, let's be clear that, you know, like, we've also got to balance the hard realities of life. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, the reality is we can't ignore the fact that 20 years from now, you may have some obligations that are really important that you start saving for now. The only way I know to make that decision, though, is, and it's very interesting, like, we don't stressing about the realities of life, I haven't met anyone that's helped, mm-hmm. right? So sometimes there's this tendency to say, I don't have time for all this garbage, right? This mindfulness stuff. I don't know. I got to go to work. Well, I don't know anybody who that's helped. I'm not saying that life isn't going to demand that we make some really hard choices. In other words, my wife and I have recently had this conversation. Mindfulness, if we want to call it that, mindfulness around money does not mean you can spend money you don't have. Mm-hmm. It's not The Secret, you know, that book where money's just going to magically show up out of the air. That's not what it means. What it means is just even the hard decisions are much better made by being a little bit quiet and being thoughtful about it and saying, all right, yeah, you know what? I do know. Because if you're just mindful and you want to be present and be in the moment and spend the money now and all that stuff that sometimes we misinterpret that sort of genre with, then you're ignoring something that's really important down the road. I don't care if you're aware of it or not. It's causing underlying stress. You know, you're thinking about it like, oh, geez, I know I should be doing something. Like living a life that's not aligned with what you say is important to you, it causes stress. And so I think that the answer to all of this is, right, like, independent of whether you have extra money to save today or you're paying down debt or let's just say you can't even see a way to make any change. You're so overwhelmed, which is unfortunately a lot of people's reality, and I've been there. You're so overwhelmed that you can't see anything you can do. Well, it doesn't do you any good to sit there and be overwhelmed about it. Like, the place to start is find something that you can control. And I was at a point in my life when we lived in Las Vegas and we were about to lose our house where there was nothing I could find. Everything seemed so out of control. I mean, I was in the hospital because of it. Like, it's so much stress. And one day I realized, and this sounds like, and I hate to do this, Luke, but it sounds a little bit like a New Age commercial or a yoga class. But one day I remembered a friend of mine said, hey, when you feel that way, there's always one thing you control, and it was your breath. And I remember linking together breaths for a period of a couple of days. And that little seed of control, that teeny little seed of control grew a little bit. And I remember a couple of days later, I was like, you know what? Okay, I think I have the energy now to figure out how bad is it really. And we sat down and did what's in chapter 3 of the book. You know, we got really clear about our current reality. And that takes some energy. And then once we got clear about our current reality, we started seeing things that we could do. Like, hey, what if I got rid of the second car we had for our family of 5 and we only had one car and I walked to and from work? Like, could we do it? Yeah, we could do that. Okay, there's a couple $100 a month. What if we got rid of the cable bill? Or what? We didn't even have cable. But you know, what other? And that little seed of control that started, frankly, all the way down at breath, grew and grew and grew to the point where 3 years later, we couldn't even recognize our financial situation anymore. So much better. So my point is, let's get clear about the idea that worrying and stressing about stuff hasn't ever really helped anyone.
Yeah, it sounds like anxiety can be one of the most damaging things to your finances in total.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely, I mean, it's damaging to your health, your fine, and it never really helps. Now, I know that's easier said than done. Like, I've been there, I've had people tell me, and I'm just listen to them and be like, that's a load of garbage, right? Like, mm-hmm. Right now, I can't even pay my mortgage. But again, finding one little thing that you can control and then focusing on that until you find a second little thing you can control. And a third thing, like, that's the only way I know to dig yourself out of a hole like that, assuming you're in one.
Does all of this have to happen, you know, on your own within the family before you go to, say, a financial advisor to seek help? Or can a financial advisor kind of guide you through this at all?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, you got to find a real financial advisor, okay. You know, so but yeah, a real one can, and so could a friend, to be honest. Like, here's the other piece that I've watched this happen probably 10 times in the last 12 months because of some community work I do in our community. And people often, when they're in those situations, particularly sort of stressful financial situations, aren't seeing clearly, right? We all have blind spots. By definition, we can't see them. And so particularly when you add stress to the situation, the blind spots may get bigger and bigger and bigger. And so to have somebody else go, hey, whoa, have you thought of this? I can't tell you how many times I've had people say, no, geez, no, I didn't even think, like, they almost feel dumb. And you have to explain to them, no, don't feel bad. You've been doing the best you can. But sometimes it takes an outside person to see it. We all need that. And it doesn't really matter if it's about financial stress at this point, like your investment decisions, even when you have tons of money. That's the value of a real advisor, is they can say, hey, whoa, time out. What you're saying isn't exactly making sense to me. Can I just ask you a couple of questions, right? Like, just to help you see the blind spots.
And part of this is has to be guessing, because there's so much you don't know about the future and what you will be and who you will be in the future. So how can you make some good guesses about what is going to make you happy, you know, 10, 20, 30 years down the road?
Yeah, I love that you're using that word, right? Because they are guesses. And the reason I think that word's so powerful is it gives you permission to relax a little bit. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, we already know you're going to be wrong anyway. Like, how are you possibly going to guess correctly exactly what you want, you know, something to look like even 5 years from now, but mm-hmm. let alone 20 or 30. So the idea is just maybe let go of even the pressure of making, you know, a correct guess and just make one, right? Like, it's sort of like, where do you think you want to be? Okay, you put the stake in the ground out there and you head that way. And even if that's like 2 years from now, right? You just graduated from college. I think I want to do this. I mean, we all know you're going to be wrong. Like, ask anybody, you know, ask any, and if you doubt that I'm telling the truth about that, ask anybody to tell you, like, I mean, I could ask you, Luke, where did you think you would be 5 years ago? Having watched what's happened to you, I guarantee you it's not where you are.
Absolutely.
You know, and if somebody had asked me, like, did you ever think you'd be writing for the New York Times? Like, no way. I would have never dared even have that as a goal or publishing a book with Penguin. So the point is, make a guess, move that direction, you know, realize it's going to be wrong. You know, that's why you got a one-page plan with a Sharpie and cardstock. You didn't carve it into granite with a chisel, right? You're going to just update it. It's a process of making a guess and making course corrections and repeating that over and over and over and over until you die.
One of the pitfalls, and I know that this, I've seen this really frustrate people I know and as well as myself, is when you look around and you compare yourself to your friends and colleagues who have succeeded in ways that you didn't expect, they didn't expect, and there seems to be two ways that this can affect someone. One way is to use that as motivation, but I've rarely seen that happen. And I think you've written about this in the book. The comparison can actually be dangerous and hurtful. So is there any way to balance that, or how do you just stop the comparison altogether?
You mean comparison with what other people are doing?
That's right.
Yeah, right. Like, such, you're such a good, I mean, it's so fun to be in a conversation with somebody who's so thoughtful about this because that's an awesome question. And again, it's like very carefully, right? We just, I think we have to think and notice the stuff we're doing, you know, check in with ourselves. Is this really what we want to be doing? And, you know, check in with ourselves in terms of our motivation. Because it's so easy. I mean, it's almost impossible. It's not impossible, but almost impossible to not get caught up in that. Like, and we tease our kids about it. We call it peer pressure and how silly. But then when we do it as adults, you know, we don't even realize, we don't even admit that we're doing it. So I just think, again, being clear about your own values allows you. Let me tell you a real quick story. We had this friend, and they were friends. Like, I knew her in high school, and my wife knew her husband in high school. And I'm just going to call him, their name isn't this, but I'm just going to call him Steve and Pam. And they were always really successful, like in high school, you know, I don't know if they were valedictorian, but that kind of person, right? Mm-hmm. Really smart. Both of them. I was like, she was a cheerleader when I was a freshman. She was a senior cheerleader, right? Like, you know, amazing people. and so I always held them in really high regard. And then when they graduated, they went on to do amazing stuff. Like, he was a consultant, an international consulting firm, and flying all over. And it was amazing. And one day we were talking to them, and they said that she was driving this old beat up minivan. And somebody asked her, like, why haven't you bought a new car? And she said, it's not in the budget. Now, what I think she meant was, right, like, we had budgeted money elsewhere. Like, I'm sure they had the money, they could have bought a new car, but they had made choices to But when she said it's not in the budget, I was like, whoa, 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 wait. The rest of us are all playing this little game. And you're not allowed to say that out loud. Like, that's what I thought in my head. I was like, well, she just broke the rule. She just said out loud. She just admitted out loud as a very successful person, that they have a budget and that this old minivan, buying a new one's not in the budget. And I remember being shocked. I mean, this was 15 years ago. I can still remember it, like being like, wait, we're all playing this game and it has this rule. And this rule is we have to pretend. And you just are breaking the rule. You're not allowed to do that. And so I remember, so like, let's realize there aren't any rules. Like, the only rule that really pays off is the one that says, hey, I'm clear about why I'm spending my money and I'm going to stick with it. And I, like, lately I've said some things like I have friends that are like, well, why don't you just get a new truck or a new motorcycle or a new this? And I'm like, hey, man, just because you can buy a new one every month if you want to doesn't mean I can. You know, like, and it's hard not to say that in a way that's judgmental of them. I don't mean it that way. I just need to be able to say, hey, it's not in the budget, right? That's okay.
Yeah, and it seems like when people say that, what they're really talking about is their priority and how they've determined right. what is important to them. And they're actually taking their values and they're using their money to follow those values. And that's something hard to do.
For sure. I think, and here's the thing, though, I think that's really important is to realize I love that word, right? So values and then kind of actions. And a recent column I wrote at Times had the image was, if you imagine a circle down at the bottom left-hand corner of the paper, it said values. And on the opposite side, there was a circle bottom right-hand corner that said actions. And there was no crossover. And then it showed those circles getting closer to the point where they were crossed over. In fact, it showed the point where they were one circle. It just said values and actions, right? Perfectly aligned. The thing you need to realize is that that process is what life is about in my mind, right? Like it can be painful when you first do it and realize, oh my gosh, there's a huge gap between my value, what I say is important to me, and what I'm actually doing. Like I've just come to this realization recently. In my circle around value says time with my kids. Like that's number one, other than time with my wife. It's, you know, time with the kids. And I'm not spending much time with them right now because I've let work take over. And so it was kind of painful to go, oh, geez, I really made. Now, I'm okay with that pain, though, because I'm like, wow, I'd rather know than keep living the pain of having it being an underlying. So I guess all I'm saying is give yourself a little bit of room, right? Give yourself a little bit of a break. Realize that when you first go through this process of being clear about your priorities and your values and how you spend your time and money, you might uncover some stuff that might be a little painful. It's okay. That pain is actually good pain. It's like the kind of pain that helps a muscle grow, right? Like it's necessary pain. And the goal is just to sort of move those things closer. And you're constantly going to be doing that. Like that's what life is about.
Well, speaking about pain, there's pain from big mistakes. And you mentioned your experience in Las Vegas. Is that something we can talk about?
Of course. All right. I 12 million people read that article. Yeah. I don't think it's a secret.
How do you avoid making a big mistake? And I think what we're kind of talking about is a bad real estate investment in your case. And in my case, I had lots of bad mistakes that led to me hitting my own personal rock bottom, which I've written about recently as well. So how is there a way that we can see this coming and maybe prevent ourselves from making these big mistakes before it's too late?
I mean, I hope that through our own personal experiences, like I'm really hopeful that I don't repeat that exact same mistake, which really, you know, I've had people say like, I mean, sometimes those mistakes are, and please don't take me the wrong way. Like I think there was a lot of stuff I actually did that I should have done different. In fact, the title of that article I wrote was I Should Have Known Better. And I think that's still true. But sometimes, you know, you just sort of get caught in the wrong place at the wrong time. And I'm not saying that for me, but realize that sometimes these things that look like you made a terrible mistake was just the function of stuff happening. You know, the wrong time, the wrong place, the wrong time. I mean, I could give you like two really simple things that if they had been slightly different, I would have never had that mistake happen. Now, again, it was my fault for putting myself that close to the edge that one wrong thing, you know, threw me over the edge. So all I'm saying is I don't know. I know that being, you know, I know that some of the most common cognitive mistakes, like projecting the recent past. It's okay. Let me give you two that I think really are at the root of a lot of these mistakes. So one is projecting the recent past into the future. So if we're talking about money, that would be something like thinking real estate's going to go up forever, especially at the rate that it was going up in 2005, 6, 7. You know, we might be in that same place. We're starting to hear people say again, like, real estate's never a bad investment. So taking the recent past, if we talk about the stock markets, kind of similar, right? Saying that the market, taking the recent past, projecting it. And the other one is forgetting that it's in the same vein, but forgetting that things change. And so one quick test that I'm really a big fan of now is the overconfidence conversation, where you just simply say, all right, like, let's say you're convinced something's going to happen. Like, okay, I'm going to invest in this bit. I'm going to quit my job and start my own company. And I'm going to put my life savings into it. And you're really sure that it's going to work out. And so you ask this question, like, if it works out the way you plan, how will your life be different? And sometimes that's, well, geez, my life will be materially different. But most of the time, it's like, well, it would be different around the edges, but it may not make a massive difference. The second question is, if you're wrong, how will your life be different? And often that answer is like, oh my gosh, I'd be in a lot of trouble, right? I'd have to go back to work for 20 years, whatever. And the third question is, have you ever been wrong before? And just sort of putting yourself in the position to realize, like, and closely related is, often we make these decisions based on the probability of something going wrong. And we calculate, like, okay, I think there's a 3% chance I might be wrong, so I'm going to do this. The only thing I ask you to add is not just the probability of you being wrong, but add the consequence. So even if there's a 3% chance, if it's going to kill you, that's a different discussion than if you would just skin your knee.
Right.
So adding consequence to probability, I think, is really important.
Would it help to have a trusted advisor between you and your actions to maybe stop you from making some bad choices?
Well, I think that a real financial advisor is worth their weight in gold because of that. Like, if they just prevent you from making a mistake, you know, that you, and the reason, and again, you're not, you shouldn't ever hire, I mean, look, I don't think you hire a financial advisor because you're not smart. I don't think you hire a financial advisor because you're not successful, right? Mm-hmm. Hopefully they are more experienced with the spreadsheet and the calculator than you are. But even if they aren't, I mean, I know some of the smartest financial people I've ever met have a personal CFO or a financial advisor in their lives because they're not them, right? So having somebody there that can be the thing between you and the big mistake.
Another set of eyes, or someone who's kind of on the outside and doesn't have an emotional investment.
Yeah. So yes. So, you know, an unbiased, unemotional third party. Now, of course, you've got to get clear about what their own conflicts of interest are and all of that other stuff. But in terms of just what their job is, I think their job is to just point things out you're not thinking of, prevent you, walk you in off the ledge when you're thinking of doing something stupid. It's really hard to walk yourself in off a ledge.
Well, I love the simplicity of your sketches. Everything, just about everything you write is accompanied by a piece of art, basically. And the sketches illustrate various things about financial realities that aren't always obvious. How did you start with sketching? Was that something that you had done before you were even interested in finance, or did it come later?
No, it was an act of desperation. I mean, I was sitting there trying to explain something to clients, and I thought it was really critical, like critical, that they understood this concept.
So,
and how did they just weren't getting it.
The sketches help communicate then?
Yeah. I mean, so I was trying to explain this, and they were smart people and they weren't getting it. So clearly I wasn't doing a very good job. And so out of an act of desperation, I was like, no, like this. And I stood up and drew it on the whiteboard. And they were like, oh, I get it now. And so that was sort of when the light bulb went on. And I thought, oh, okay, I need to see if I can do this every time. So, yeah, the goal of the sketches is that they act as a shortcut to the idea. And then they also act as I think of them as shortcuts and souvenirs. They also act as a souvenir of the experience you've had together, the learning experience.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Was there a point when you realized that what you were doing with the sketches was fairly unique and could be something that kind of helped you in your writing or bolstered your career or just gave you sort of a personal brand that helped identify yourself.
I try to be really careful about looking backwards and sort of crafting a narrative out of stuff that happened, but I sort of thought everybody did this. I think we all have that problem, is we have sort of a unique talent and we think because we do it and it's easy. I mean, it's not easy necessarily, but because we do it, that it must be that everybody does it. And so I kept having people tell me over the years. I mean, it took a long time. It was like somebody had to hit me with a bat a couple times saying, "Hey, this is unique." When I finally said, "Oh wait, you know what? It is. I think the conversational tone of the writing and the images are what makes my work unique. If there's something that makes it unique, that's what it is."
Do you start with the writing and build sketches from that, or does the idea for the sketch come first for you?
It depends. Often it's the writing, or maybe it's at least the idea. Like, okay, like I'm just with the idea for this upcoming week's column for the New York Times is about finding a third way. I'm talking about, like, often in money we say this is my way, and your spouse may say, but this is the way I see it, and you're just so hung up on how each other can't see the other person's way that you don't even have the tools to find that there might be even a third or better way. So that was the idea, and I this morning on my mountain bike ride, I was like, I want to write about the third way, and so I thought, how can I illustrate that? And then I started working on the illustration. So I hadn't done all the writing yet, but I knew the core idea was the third way, and so I thought, well, how could I illustrate the third way? And I've got the illustration right in front of me now. So now I've got the illustration. I got to go flesh out the idea in terms of the writing, but it doesn't always happen that way. Sometimes I've written the whole column. I'm like, oh my gosh, how am I possibly going to draw this? You know. And then other times it's like I have this really cool actual sketch in my mind, and I think, well, I got to write something to fit that.
The sketches, though, they're more than just illustration and communication. They are art. And has there been any kind of reception to them as art?
Yeah, I've done a solo art show, an 8-week solo art show, 50 pieces here in Park City. I did an exhibition in London. I did an exhibition in Belgium. I did one in Northern California, and we've got one next January in St. Louis, Missouri. So yeah, we're doing like real live art shows, and believe me, I don't know how that happened. I just, it's super fun, and a lot of people buy them we sell them online. A lot of people buy either the printed version or the digital version and hang them on their wall. I have countless, I don't know if it's thousands, but hundreds and hundreds of pictures of people's walls with the art up there.
So I know you said you don't know how it happened, but how did it happen? I mean, I really want to know how you went from, writing about finances and sketching to actually being to showing your art.
Yeah. So here's how it happened. I had a financial advisor say to me, and I can remember him, and for some reason I'm blanking on his name. I know he lives in Reno, Nevada. He said to me, "Hey, I want one of these. I want one of these on my wall. Will you print one large?" And I was kind of like, "Oh, you're crazy, man! What are you talking about?" This was, 6 or 7 years ago. And then he said to me a couple weeks later, he's like, "No, I've been thinking more about it. Like, I want this one right here, and I want it big. And if I get it printed, will you sign it?" And that's when I was like, "Dude, you're nuts." And he goes, "Well, guess what? I'll give you $5 for an unsigned one, and I'll give you $100 for a signed one." And I said, "Where's the pen?" right. So that was the first time. And then I was like, "Wow, if he wants one, maybe other people do." And which is the same thing everything's been. I've been like, "Oh, that's interesting." I was sort of getting hit by a stick, like somebody was saying, "I really want this," and they were actually, he demanded it, right? So then I said, "Well, maybe somebody else." And then we sort of slowly started doing it, and then a big art center asked me to come give a talk about using illustrations to help people understand a complex subject like money. And at the end of the talk, the exhibition director there pulled me aside and said, "Hey, would you do a show for us?" And I was like, I had learned by this point to say yes and figure things out later. So I was like, "Yeah, I will." And I went outside and was like, "What in the world is that?" Like 50, she said, a 50 piece solo show. You'd have the whole main gallery. And this is like on Main Street in Park City. It's where Oprah announced the O Network. Like, wow. it's a, really punches above its weight in terms of, you know, like cute little Park City. It's a pretty influential place art wise. I was like, what? So I called one of my friends and was like, hey, how do I do this? I called one of my real artist friends. I was like, how do I do this? His name's Nelson. And he came over to my office and I was like, I don't know what this means. Like, do I need to learn how to do watercolors? Do I do acrylic? Like, what do I do? And I was drawing some stuff up on this old weathered chalkboard I have in the office still. And he was like, Carl, what if you just did old weathered chalkboards? And I was like, what are you you're nuts. And he finally talked me into it. So we did these old weathered chalkboards. Then we had to figure out how to price it. You didn't ask about this, but I got to tell you. I was like, how do we price this? Like, it's an old beat up chalkboard with one of my images on it. How do we price it? And the person I asked to help me with that, she was like, well, you know, everything else is priced per square foot. Why don't you do it per square foot? I was like, okay. So we a 3x3 chalkboard at this show was $1,800.
Wow.
And they all sold.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was like I walked in to opening night and I didn't know that they did it this way, but you know, there's those little cards next to art in galleries that has a little description and maybe the price on it. And there was all these black dots on the cards opening up. There's like 150 people there. I mean, I actually had to walk back outside 3 times and almost threw up in the parking lot. I was so nervous because I was like, what is going on here? Mm-hmm. I walk in, there's 150 people. I see all these black dots. I'm like, oh, that must mean something bad, right? Like, it's a black dot. Well, that means sold.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. So anyway, it was crazy. That's how it happened.
And do you continue to do that?
Yeah, it's a lot of work. So I like to do sort of one a year. And our next one is in a gallery community art space in St. Louis in January. It'll run for about, I can't remember if it's 8 or 10 weeks. And we involve the community. Like this one, we're going to try and bring MBA students and MFA students. So Masters of Fine Arts students and Masters of Business Administration students to a workshop where we make the MBAs draw and the MFAs explain. Right? Like, we're not going to let the MFAs touch anything. Like, they have to keep their hands to themselves, but they have to talk about the concept. And so we're going to take a concept like diversification and say, all right, how would you guys illustrate that? And MFAs, you can just talk, you can't draw. Right? Like, it's the kind of stuff I really like to do.
Yeah, that sounds like an amazing project. I'd love to see how that comes together.
Yeah, for sure. I'll let you know. So it is January of, what is that, 16?
So we have a lot of bloggers in the financial community who they would love to publish a book through a publisher. How did you take the column that you had been writing, just like our bloggers have been writing for years and years and have quite an extensive compendium of articles at this point. How do you focus and turn all of that into a book that would be interesting?
Yeah, I love that question. I'm a huge fan of byproducts, right? So, you know, I think the act of blogging by itself, and I love how Seth Godin talks about this, that just the act of sort of metacognition, thinking about your thinking. Mm-hmm. He's like, if I don't get anything else out of blogging, that's valuable. Okay. Mm-hmm. So you start there and then you're like, okay, great. I'm building an audience and yeah, I've got a product here or there. But one of the byproducts clearly is that you've got this big pile. This is exactly what happened to me. I was like, okay, we'd been doing it through 2 or 3 years, about 1,000 words a week. And I woke up one day, I was like, wow, look at that big pile over there on the table of 30,000 words, and I was like, I wonder if we took that now. And I didn't want to slap together. There's plenty of those books and some of them are really good. I'm not saying they're bad. I just didn't want to do it this way where you just slap together blog posts. So I just said instead, like, what's in here? Like, what's the common themes? You know, what narrative could we draw through the whole thing? And so I think that's what you do, right? You just take this huge, I remember we took, it's probably like 50. Well, what would it be? Yeah, it would be more like 100. Because we were doing one a week. And I have an image that represents each idea, right? So mm-hmm. We just actually printed out all 50 images. And we did this in the basement of my house. And we taped them to the wall and moved them around until we thought, okay, that's an interesting narrative. And then we knew behind each image was about 1,000 words. And so then we grabbed the words and organized it that way. And of course, it made no sense at that point. It was just a series of slapped together blog posts. And then we said, okay, now how can we craft this together? And sometimes that involves getting somebody else involved. Like, you may be really good That's a unique skill. I've always had somebody else involved. So I always get like an old fashioned editor, not like the kind that exists at many publishers now, but like an old fashioned editor that can take 50,000 words of relatively unorganized content and say, "Hey, Carl, I think there's something here and here and here." And so and that could just be a spouse, a friend that you just say, "Hey, help me with this." Because it might be a different skill set than blogging. And then again, it might not be, but that's how I do it.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. I mean, I was going to ask that when you said that you used the word we, so I figured that you had some help there. It's good to see that, you know, I think bloggers and writers, bloggers are writers, but I think everybody kind of focuses in on the skill set that they have that's very good. And for a lot of us who have been publishing, that is the actual act of, you know, publishing your thoughts, writing articles. When it comes to putting something together that in a condensed form or in a publishable form, it seems to require a different skill set.
I'm a big fan of slowly trying to figure out what I'm uniquely skilled at and trying to get people around me that are uniquely skilled at the stuff I'm not at. Like, for instance, I'll give you an idea. I have not seen the inside of my email for, we're almost on 6 months now. I don't have the login. I don't have the password. My assistant, Kara, who's way more than an assistant, when I hired her, I mentioned offhandedly, I said, I've been wanting to get rid of email for so long. The next day I came in and she had changed my password and wouldn't give it to me. So when people email me, this is sort of off tangent, but when people email me, carl@behaviorgap.com, if you get a reply, it's signed by me. It is absolutely from me. I want to be clear about that. Like, the way that works is she prepares a brief two times a day that says, you know, Luke emailed you, he wants to know this, this, and this, and this. And then I literally write in that brief, it's a Word document, I write the reply. She just cuts and pastes it into the email. So it's from me. So don't be confused about that. But that's only like 10% of the emails require a reply from me. Most of the time, she's able to say, "Hey, John, this is Kara. Carl asked me to reply. It looks like you need to book a time." Now, some people are like, "Well, geez, I got delegated to the..." No, actually, that's a sign of my love and respect for you because she'll get it done.
Right.
Otherwise, you and I will be trading emails for 10 years and we'll never have a conversation and I'll miss the appointment and I'll blow it off and all because I'm not good at that. So it's back to this editing idea that editing is, I think, a skill that takes an outside pair of eyes. And so if you're a blogger, I would highly encourage you to create, even if you decided I'm going to create a 10,000 word ebook that draws all this sort of narrative together, it gives people a souvenir of the work they've been reading. You'd be shocked at how many people buy a book. Like, I know lots of these guys that have just slapped together blog posts and they almost haven't done any more work than that. And they tell people, like, "Hey, look, everything I've written here is on my blog." But people still want it because it's a souvenir of the experience.
Do you think you've made the right choice in publishing through Penguin? I mean, how does that opportunity come about, and is there an advantage to that over publishing an ebook, self-publishing a printed book?
Yeah, this is a really challenging subject for me to talk about simply because I realize that I've been really lucky. You know, I don't know. There's not really a set of lessons, and you're never going to see a book from me that says, you know, 4 great ways to secure a huge book deal, right? Like, because there's no, I think the only lesson I have for any that's a value to anyone is play in traffic and hope you get hit. And don't expect to, and I don't even know if hope, that may not be the right word. Play in traffic might be the right way to put it, right?
Sounds dangerous.
Yeah, it does sound dangerous. But the idea is just, I mean, a better way to put it is write good stuff and make it easy to spread. Repeat over and over and over. Mm-hmm. You know, have no expectation of anything other than that. And it's so, but to answer your question specifically, for me, the experience of publishing with both these books have been with Penguin has been awesome, right? Like I've enjoyed the process. It financially, it's been rewarding. So that's the calculation I think you make, is in the end of the day, and I think I'm not revealing anything and nobody knows, but you're going to have to write the book, whether you do it traditionally with a traditional publisher or not. You're going to have to write the book and sell the book. Nobody else is going to do that for you. Mm-hmm. And but sell is maybe a crass word to use, but you know what I mean? Like, you're going to have to market and spread and share the book, and nobody else is going to do that for you, you know, barring like the top 0.1%. I mean, now it's like, it's not the top 10%. It's like almost no one. You know, you've got to build your own platform, market your own book, sell your own book. So then at the end of the day, it really comes down to a financial calculation, because chances are you're also probably going to get some outside editorial help that you pay for out of your pocket. Even mm-hmm. if the editors at the traditional publishers are really good, you're going to probably still want some outside help. So, you know, at the end of the day, really, all of a sudden you've done everything other than get your book in the airports and some of the, you know, independent and big bookstore chains, you know, Barnes & Noble and the airports. That's the only thing that traditional publishers bring to the table, that and money. And so, and again, I make sure that I stated this right. Like, the editorial help you get from a traditional publisher can be incredibly valuable, right? Mm-hmm. But so the calculation becomes, you know, which one's a better bet in terms of it working out for everyone financially? And by everyone, I mean the publisher too, because in order for it to be a good business relationship, it's got to work out for them too. So that's the calculation. It's pretty easy. In fact, I think Tim Grawl has a great calculator on his site on traditional versus self-publish. It's just a calculator. You plug in a couple variables and it'll give you an idea which one might be better. Now, let's assume you want a traditionally published. How does it happen? You know, I think that's the, like, write good stuff and spread it. Mm-hmm. Because I literally got a phone call. I mean, I had an agent at the time, but we couldn't get a proposal done because I hate writing proposals. So it was like 6 months and I was still like, I'm not going to write the. And then I literally got a phone call out of the blue. They didn't know I had an agent from Penguin. And she said, hey, I've read everything you've written. I've printed it out. I've laid it out in chapters. I'm calling to see if you'll write a book for me. And I was like, well, that's funny. I have an agent. I just don't want to write a proposal. And she said, well, can we make you a preemptive offer? And I said, I'm a kid from the hills in Utah. I don't even know what that means. Like, call my agent. And they, 3 days later, we had a book deal.
That's so amazing.
How would you plan that? So the only thing you can do really is focus on what you can control, write good stuff, put it in a way that's easy to spread.
Have you given any thought to what you want to talk about at your keynote at FinCon?
Yeah, I want to talk about the amazing place that I'm now thinking of FinCon more in the terms of like financial educators, right? Like, I don't care if that's a blogger, a journalist, a financial advisor, like people who are really trying to make a difference in how people treat money. And that is such a beautiful, sacred spot for me. That I want to talk about that, and I want to talk about my story and how it happened, only from the point of view of saying, you know, it's, and compare it a little bit to compound interest, right? Like, there was a whole period of time that was insanely boring. You know, like, my mom and my sister were reading my stuff and my sister was lying. It was just my mom. And you know, and then suddenly the curve started to head up. And often we're trying to find shortcuts to that steep end of the curve, both in our investments and in our business lives. If we're content creators, we want to, okay, what SEO tool could I use? What consultant could I hire? And what I think the lesson of Seth Godin is really fascinating to me. You go back and look, there's actually somebody who's plotted out, you know, his readership and his views and his number of posts. It looks just like a compound interest curve. There were years. We all look at Seth now and say like, oh yeah, but he can say that because he's Seth. Well, no, he's been saying that for 10 years. And he just did it every single day. And there was a whole bunch of time that was boring. And the point is, if you want to get to the exciting end of the curve, you've got to go through the boring part. There's no shortcuts. No shortcuts in investing and content creation. There's no shortcuts. You got to go through. So if you understand that, you start to realize the boring part's actually exciting, right? Because you you know you got to do it. So that's kind of what I'm excited to talk about. It's just this, the sacred role that we all play in terms of being financial educators, and how really the talk may be called How to Change the World. It's a humble talk. But anyway, How to Change the World, because I believe so passionately in your ability to do it.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And you know, what you're saying matches my experience as well with consumerism commentary, you know, on a smaller scale, obviously, than either Seth Godin or yourself. But, you know, just seeing that curve, getting to the exciting part of the curve was very exciting for me.
Isn't that true?
And now, though, now I'm kind of I'm after that point. And it's just always been a big question for me is, you know, what's next and what am I going to do to match that or even to get as much satisfaction as I got out of it, you know, several years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fascinating. I love Seth's idea of like just continuing to scale trust.
Right.
Right. Just continue to scale trust so that if I say, hey, here, I made this. Here it is for you. Do you like it? That there's a group of people out there that will at least trust me enough to check it out.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I know that I'll get, and hopefully they'll trust me enough to be honest with me about what they felt so I can keep making it better and better and better over time. And I think that's a really fun place to be.
Yeah, that sounds really great. And I'm looking forward to hearing the keynote and to seeing you at VinCon. Well, that was Carl Richards, author of The One-Page Financial Plan, available from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other retailers. You can even download a free chapter of the book at onepagefinancialplan.com, and you can read Carl's Sketch Guy column in the New York Times. Thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.